Christian Parenting.
Welcome to the Living Wholehearted Podcast. We are Jeff and Tara Mattson, a husband and wife team who is shrinking the integrity gap in our own lives and helping others do the same. I'm a leadership and organizational development coach, and Tara is a licensed marriage and family therapist.
We believe that if you have a following, you are a leader, and how you lead matters. Whether you are leading in the home, work, or community, we are bringing you biblical, clinical, and relational wisdom to help you in every relationship that matters most to you. None of us do this perfectly, but we are leaning into the reality of our humanity and profound wisdom of grace. So we're in the middle of a series on healing from church wounds. One area we have struggled with as a church, but we're getting increasingly better on, is the theology of suffering. It's not a fun topic. Nobody likes to talk about it, but it's the crux of our human existence and experience, and even of our faith as followers of Jesus. It's rooted in the suffering of our Lord Jesus Christ. And our podcast, we're focusing on bridging the gap between that clinical, biblical, and relational wisdom. So we're so excited to have our guest with us today, Dr. Kurt Thompson, who has been a colleague in the field and one that we look to and lean into his books and his research. We're so grateful for him today.
Well, if you don't know Dr. Kurt Thompson, he's a Christian psychiatrist working at the intersection of neuroscience and spiritual formation, the best-selling author of many books, including his latest, The Deepest Place. Inspired by deep compassion for others and informed from a Christian perspective, he shares how to have more authentic relationships and fully experience our deepest longing, which is to be known. Kurt and his wife Phyllis live outside of Washington, D.C., and that gives you a little idea into who their clientele might be, and have two adult children. Kurt, it's really great to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, Jeff and Tara, it's a privilege to be with you. I would say that... Also, in knowing the work that you're doing, we like to say that the brain can do a lot of hard things for a long time, as long as it doesn't have to do it by itself. And so I'm really grateful for being with you today and knowing that you know that a lot of life is just about doing hard things and what it means to be present for people. So that they're not by themselves when they're doing it. So thanks for all the work that you're doing as well. It's a privilege to be with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm borderlining on like wanting to have this intelligent conversation with you and not like going wigging out as a fan. Because to be honest, you know, we've taught together at the AACC, American Association for Christian Counselors, so that those that are in the helping field or pastors and want to learn. And I've sat in on Dr. Kurt's workshops over the years and then have come up over time and said, yes, yes, yes. And then many of your books have been so helpful for leaders, particularly in the church, better understanding their own humanity, the connection. But as a play therapist and a trauma therapist, I've been leaning into Dr. Dan Siegel's work for a couple of decades now. And you've done a beautiful job of integrating the neuroscience and our Christian formation, and just peeling it out down into the layers of making it more normal for everybody to understand, here's what we really need as human beings. So before we dive into that, give us a little insight to your story. Maybe peel back the curtain and help our audience know a little bit about you and who you are before we dive into your expertise.
Well, thanks. Thanks. It's very kind. So important things about me, kind of working backward. I've been married for almost 37 years to Phyllis, and that's been, one of the primary forming relationships for me in the course of my adult life. We've got two adult kids who also, I don't deserve to be their dad. I mean, I'm just so grateful for the work that they do at living. Both of them, and so that's just it's a good thing. I I tell people that Jesus has been finding me in over time in multiple different moments. You know, probably kind of being reared in an evangelical Quaker tradition in that family, growing up in a very small town in eastern Ohio. My parents were in their mid-40s when I was born. I have brothers that were much older than me, all three of whom have passed from cancer at this point. Mm. I count myself as a professional sinner. Like I don't mess around. I'm like, I'm just really good at it. I don't, you know, you just, if you've done something for a long time and you're really effective at it, you can call yourself a pro. So that's true of me. And this notion that Jesus finds me first in the community and then at a church camp when I was 13, where significant encounter with the Holy Spirit there. And then entering into a 20-year-long kind of waxing and waning existential crisis that formed me, really. It was, you know, a combination of my own temperament and my own rumination and my family history and, you know, unfinished business, wounds that weren't healed, all the things that shape who we are. I think I was found then when I went off to medical school. I was not very enthusiastic about it and was pretty miserable for the first 2.5 years of being in school. And then out of the blue, I feel like Jesus came once again to find me in psychiatry. Psychiatry was not on my radar at all. And yet I believe that in the course of walking into that space, God opened a door for me to do the things that I think I was made to do, but didn't really know that at the time. And then about 20 years ago, when in 2004, when I when Dan Siegel and I first became acquainted and had the chance to work with him over a period of a few years, mm-hmm. which led to this work of integration with interpersonal neurobiology and Christian spiritual formation that kind of brings us to today. So I can tell you that 5, let alone 10 years ago, I would never have imagined being on this podcast with you today. It wouldn't have been a thing. It's not like I've been planning my life. I'm not that smart to do that. I'm really grateful. And then I guess the last thing I will say is that, like, just like current moment is that I'm discovering just how full my life is with envy. Mm. I'm just envious of everything and everybody. It's like there's nowhere I go where it's not happening. Mm. And so, you know, it's one thing when you discover something that is true about your life that feels kind of overwhelming because it's really kind of not very fun to discover and it's just everywhere, but it also kind of clears the playing field because now you know where the work is. Like, okay. I don't have to wonder whether it's like, oh, where am I going to do my work on envy? Will I have to? No, it'll just open your eyes today, Kurt. It'll be waiting for you. So, yeah, there you go.
Be waiting for you. Well, like a present.
I love it. I love how honest you are, because I think there's this idea that, I mean, even in the name of our company, Living Wholehearted, there's very intention in like the action verb of living, and wholehearted being an idea of mind, body, heart, soul integration work is where that comes from Old Testament piece. But the idea that we've arrived, like at some point you're going to be whole. Or at some point, you're going to be done sinning. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate kind of you speaking to the fact that you're still working on this envy thing, and it seems to be everywhere. Yeah. So,
Yeah. I'm glad we'll have eternity because I'm going to have, there's going to be a long conversation that Jesus and I will be having about, like, I'm not really all that thrilled about his plan for sanctification. I think there could have been a better way to do this.
Could have just done this.
Well, he could have done this a little more quickly. I'm just glad we're going to have a long time for that conversation.
Yeah. He's heard it before. He can take it.
Yeah.
Well, Kurt, you gave us a little insight just into this question that I wanted to ask, and is the example on envy. But your work at the intersection of neuroscience and Christian spiritual growth, you know, for you, how has the work that you've been doing and integrating impacted you in your own heart, mind, body, and soul? I mean, that you gave us one little snippet there. Anything else you'd say as it relates to your faith journey in that, which sounds again like the adventure of what faith a journey should be with Jesus. It should be a kind of messy.
There is this sense in which, like a lot of things in life, like a lot of learning processes, children go into school, and we go to school ostensibly because we want to demonstrate how smart we are, but in fact we go to school actually to be revealed what we don't know, which is everything, there's, you know, everything that I don't know. And so we have these encounters with things in the world, everything from math to reading to whatever, and only to discover in that moment that, like, see spot run. I might be able to do that, but like, yeah, War and Peace, that's not happening for me. Right. There's lots of things I don't know. And so the encounter with all the things that we're learning, that we have been learning over the last, especially that have been written about and talked about in the last 20 years about neuroscience, is extraordinarily fascinating and intriguing and captivating. And simultaneously, you learn about, like, oh, emotion is everywhere. And then you're like, crap, emotion is everywhere. And, you learn something, and then you discover, and then you have to, like, live into it. I wrote a book a few years ago about shame. And, you write these things, and then you discover, oh, my gosh, I have an ocean of it behind this wall. And you write about it, and then, like, the writing is the invitation to then begin to do the work. And so even now, this book on suffering is, in some respects, it's kind of like you write something as a way to stick your toe into the water of what you suspect somewhat uncomfortably that God is inviting you to encounter. And you think, like, well, maybe if I just write about it, maybe write. You know, if I'm an addict, I think that just going to the meetings is the same thing as being in recovery. Mm-hmm. If I just, just writing the book somehow is. So anyway, yeah. So it has invited me. You try to think, and then you have to live into what you're imagining. And we talk about this all the time, that a lot of the work that you do in coaching and psychotherapy and so forth and so on is what you're doing is you are imagining things for other people that they are too frightened and too ashamed to even, like, literally they can't do it. Some are too afraid to do it, but many of them can't even do it. And so you're imagining things while you're waiting for their imagination to catch up to you.
Yeah.
And you're not waiting for, and by that, you're not just waiting for, like, this abstract thing that we call imagination to, like, come up with ideas or images in their head, that you're really talking about them being in the room with you and they're watching you be completely comfortable and confident in the presence of them, which of course they aren't. This is, like, I am my biggest problem. I am mostly uncomfortable with me.
Right.
And until I am able to be comfortable enough with watching you be comfortable with me being uncomfortable, but you know what I mean. I mean, when you do
that's the work.
You're in, right. And it takes time to do this. It takes practice. It's like a teacher with their second grader. It's like a coach with their, with their field hockey player. It's we're just going to do this drill over and over. We're going to watch you. We're not just doing it to take up time. We're doing it because we're building new neural networks. We have to do this over and over. We're practicing. Okay, I'll stop.
No, I love that. And it makes me think two things. So one is helping people imagine where they could go and what they could be. But also in that imagining, we have to look at what is. And I think you speak beautifully to this about the being known. And sometimes I'm just mirroring back what I see in the room with delight. And reframing it in a way that feels good, right, for the client that has been told that's bad. So, I don't have to imagine anything, but just reflect back what I'm seeing with a different lens.
Right. Or hearing and noticing. I hear yeah, frustration in your voice. Yeah. Is there frustration, noticing?
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right, right. Noticing those things. I think noticing those things and doing so with your own sense of comfort and confidence, that not unlike what you're doing with a newborn.
Right.
Right. The newborn's brain doesn't know anything but how to be in distress. And it's not going to calm itself. The newborn is going to depend upon the co-regulation of the touch and feel and sound of voice and body of the mom and the dad in order for it to, again, turn on neurons that otherwise can't turn on by itself. It needs an outside, you know, mind to do that. So
God's design is incredible. Well, I want to ask you a little bit about the new book. It comes comes out of the years of working with grief, loss, and suffering. Kurt, how do you define suffering? How do you define hope? What are these two hallmarks here in this?
Yeah. Well, I think you know, there's all kind of the scientific literature is pretty replete with, you know, conversations about this and definitions of this. The way the shorthand that I use is that suffering is our response to pain over time. It's a pretty simple math equation, if you will. Mm-hmm. We often talk about pain being the distress that we experience, whether it's emotional, psychological, physical, that is imparted upon us. Something happens to me that is painful, whether it's a cut on my finger or the cancer that's diagnosed or the marriage that breaks up, whatever this is. Suffering has to do with how I then respond to it, what my affective, what my emotional responses are, but also then the meaning that I begin to make of my own emotional responses. Not just the meaning I'm making of what has happened to me, but the meaning that I'm actually making of my response to it. And all of this depends upon a couple of features that are unique to us as humans. One of them has to do with the way we tell time. We have the capacity to imagine time in the future in ways that, as far as we know, no other animal does. So I don't just, you know, I'm not just aware of where I'm going to go to find, you know, the corn that I need to eat today if I'm a deer, but I'm also imagining what's going to happen 6 weeks from now and 6 months from now. And there's a story that I'm telling in the course of that imagined future. And that is the thing that no other animal tends to do. And we also say, though, that what I do with my future, how I anticipate, and the story that I create about my future is a remembered event. I don't ever construct my future de novo. I construct it out of a collection of remembered features of my past experience. That's all that I have as a human. And so this is why we say that we remember our future. We don't just construct it. We don't simply anticipate it. We are remembering it in some respects. And so what I do with pain is going to have a lot to do with what I remember my most recent and past experiences of pain to have been like. And by that, we don't just mean the pain itself, but also my response to it. And another feature then that is significant as far as suffering is concerned has to do with the degree to which I, as a human being, we always, as our friends at the Bible Project like to say, there's nothing about human beings that you can't learn by reading the first six pages of the Bible. Everything you need to know. And one of the first things that we see in the second page, on the second page of the Bible, is that it's not good for humans to be alone. This is really not helpful. My suffering becomes more acute, more sharpened when I'm experiencing pain in isolation. And so it's not just a feature of my capacity to tell time and the what I do and the story that I tell into the future about what's happening with my pain, but it also has a lot to do with the degree to which I find myself being alone in that process. Job, for all of the companionship that his buddies seemed to want to offer him, given their posture toward him, didn't. I mean, he still looked like he was pretty much by himself, even though there were other dudes in the room. This was a problem for him that did not help his suffering. And we talk about how then suffering also happens in three different ways, whether there are things that happen to us, events that have happened to us that we have no control over, whether it's, you know, the injury that I sustained as a kid, whether a loss of my father when I was a child, whether it was the sexual abuse, all the things that my son was killed in Iraq, all the things that happened to us. By far, the suffering that we sustain is shaped by the second thing, and that is what we do to ourselves. Things happen to us, but then I begin to tell a story about that event, and the story that I'm telling, and if I'm telling it by myself, I am more likely to suffer with it. The story that I'm telling is going to be the thing that has far more impact on me over time than even the event itself. And then there's a third category of suffering, and that's the suffering that the New Testament talks about when it talks about what it means for us to suffer alongside Jesus in the way that he suffered. And we say there is a particular kind of suffering that takes place when we are running or walking or crawling to the light. And for us to give up my addiction, for me to give up my envy, for me to give up my resentment, for me to allow myself to be loved, is often an extraordinarily, excruciatingly painful process. You look around and you see it doesn't take rocket science to see that we're not very good at loving one another. We have all kinds of evidence for that. And you think like, oh, actually, I wish we could be better at that. I mean, heaven knows, I mean, from our pop music to our movies, to our literature, to whatever, heaven knows that we all believe that like all we need is love, right? I mean, the Beatles tell us everything we need to know. And we think that it's just that easy. We need love and we all want it. And if it's available, I'll receive it. What I think the data just plainly indicates, however, is that this is just basic laws of physics. And that is that we can't give anybody what we don't have. And so to the degree that I'm not able to love someone, not willing to love someone, has everything to do with the degree to which in that place I have yet to be receptive to being loved. And so even though we're not good at loving others, we're even less capable of being receptive to love. And in my suffering, it's easy for me to remain isolated and cut off, which only tends to exacerbate it. And also has me then telling the story that my suffering really doesn't have anything to do with what I'm doing. It has to do with what's happening to me and only that. But the scriptures, I think, are clear in that God in his presence certainly is intending to transform our experience of suffering itself, even as he invites us to allow him to love us, especially in those places where the greatest pain is. Which is not easy for me to do. I'm just way too defensive. I'm way too afraid. Like, because we are, our suffering often takes place. It emerges in the context of these intimate relationships. And we're not resistant to love because we're stupid or because weak or because we're cowards or because we're not working hard enough at life. We're resistant because we're like not stupid, because like I remember like how this happened before. And I'm not gonna let life fool me again. And so it takes great courage for us. Recently I've just been talking a lot. It took great courage. With fear and trembling, she came. The woman in Matthew in Mark 5 who had the bleeding problem, right? Mm-hmm. She has a plan. For healing. She has a plan. Commando healing. We're going to get in, get the job done, get out. And then he stops the crowd and like all hell breaks loose for her. Right? This becomes a problem. And he asks, who touched me? And the text reads with fear and trembling. Like you think, oh, I did. Like, no, because she's not even yet aware of where her suffering actually most deeply lies. She just thinks that she has this, I just got to get the bleeding stopped. And Jesus has no intention of just stopping with our bleeding.
Yeah. Amen. He goes the deep. He calls her daughter. That's one of my favorite places where I see trauma and the peace of being known and the fear and trembling and all the repair that has to happen from that point forward where her neural pathways have to be over and over and over redone from that moment. So he heals her, but we can imagine what's happening after as she has to re-engage in community after being an outcast for so long. And I hear that from so many people, especially when we think about church wounds. You go, you want me to trust a God who his people have hurt me, or my most trusted mentor. And we love the Bride of Christ, but we know it's full of a bunch of humans. So when you said that being known or the suffering brings, I guess, hope. I'll reframe what I think you're saying. Hope is in the being able to suffer with others, knowing that we're not alone. It gets worse when we feel alone. And God's presence is a part of that equation. So speak to that person who's like, yeah, I haven't felt God near. I haven't felt people stick it out with me in my suffering. And you speak deeply about attachment in Jesus. So connect all of that for us.
Well, I do. One thing I guess I didn't answer this part of the question that you asked earlier, Jeff, and that, you know, and that's the question of hope. And I think one thing to know is that hope is not a random thing that we either acquire or don't acquire. We have or we don't have. It drops into our lap, or maybe it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then I'm one of the unfortunate ones. Hope is something we form. It is something that we create. And what we're often not aware that we're actually doing that from the moment that we come into the world. We're forming hope all the time with any kind of attachment, whether it, even to the degree that it's not even completely secure, we're forming some kind of hope. Like I hope that I come home and I hope that my house is still going to be there. Like I don't know that I'm hoping that, but that's exactly what I'm doing. But the reason that I am able to hope that it's there is because, you know, for the last several years, I've come home and there it's been.
Yeah, you have the memory of it is what you're, to your earlier point.
Right. That's exactly what we're doing. We are, this is why we form hope. And, you know, I think of the story in Exodus 5, where, you know, the opening scene of Exodus 5, Moses and Aaron come to Pharaoh and they say, dude, here we're messengers and it's time to let our people go. And like the next thing you know, everything gets worse, right? Everything gets worse.
It seems to always go that like, way.
Holy freaking cow. If I'm Moses, I'm like, this was really a bad idea. And if I'm Aaron, like I didn't even see the burning bush. I'd be like, no, this is a really bad idea. And so like it just keeps going. Like where did these guys have the wherewithal to stick around? Like I would have been throwing my staff down and leaving. I'm just like, and so this notion, so to our listener who's had experiences, even where we've tried, like, okay, we're going to trust God. Like, this is a bad situation. We got a bad king on the throne, but I got this, you know, the staff that can become a snake. Great. We're going to go try this. And then you go try this. And then like really like worse things happen. And I want to, I think what this does, that, like that story reminds me, like it is emblematic of so many of our stories. Like this, the Hebrew writers of this passage would insert this because like this is what life is like. This is not the exception. This is often the case for us who are already in trouble and then we try the next thing. Like our woman in Mark 5, she'd gone to the next doctor and the next doctor and the next doctor, and like door after door after door just leads to bad outcomes. And at some point, you figure like, no, I'm done. I'm just done with this. To which I would say, it makes complete sense. It makes complete sense. And I will say to that person, if they're listening, the fact that they're listening to you on this podcast means that they're still hopeful for something.
That's right.
There's a part of them that is hoping. And our job is to say, is to come alongside and say, you're absolutely right. This whole hoping business is really hard to do. It is not easy. And if you find it difficult, it's because like you have a pulse. Yeah. It's not because there's something wrong with you. We would say, evil is counting on you assuming that hope is so hard, it will not ever be found. Evil's counting on this. What it is not counting on is wholehearted podcast. That's what evil's not counting on. That's what evil doesn't see coming. Seriously, like the people are listening to whom we would say, look, I want you to find one more person. I want you to find one person to whom you can say, would you be willing to listen to me tell my story? And if that person turns out to be a failure, then we're going to ask you to find one more person. And then one more person until we find who we need. The work of Paul Borgman, former professor at Gordon College, north of Boston, wrote a book called Genesis, The Story We Haven't Heard, which was a composite of a literature course on Genesis that he taught. And in this, he talks about the person of Abraham, and he asks this question. Who knows how many people God asked to go with him to Canaan before Abram finally said yes? We don't know because there's no story there. But we do know that by the time you fast forward to the New Testament, that Jesus asks all kinds of people who say no. And they got all kinds of reasons for not wanting to follow him. And we would suspect that Abram may not have been the first or the second or the tenth person that God has asked to come alongside. And God knows how hard it is to take risks that lead to healing and wholeheartedness. And in some respects, we would say this is part of why God's work takes so long, because it is so painstaking. He is not willing to be anything but completely thorough. And he's waiting for many of us to gather up the courage to eventually join him in the process, especially those of us who've had experiences in life that want to persuade us that hope is just a wisp.
We just want to take a moment to tell you about Living Wholehearted. We are a wonderful team of professional counselors and executive coaches who come alongside leaders helping you live with integrity in every area of your life.
Yeah, so our newest member, executive coach, leadership consultant, Joe. Joe has got over four decades of senior leadership experience. He's a CEO of CEOs in companies like Verizon, American Airlines, Accenture, and others. Joe is, there's not been a fire or a situation that he hasn't experienced in his decades of senior leadership. And so we love having Joe. Joe brings a quality that I can't bring. I've got a few gray hairs here, but he has a seasoned leadership experience and decades of it. So that's Joe.
Connie has been a writer. She works with women in all sacred and secular spaces. She's got four kids. She knows what it's like to be running a career as well as running a home. And she also has launched churches. She understands ministry and work life. She's an incredible executive coach. Rhonda has 30 plus years working as a pastor herself, and she is spending her retirement working on helping pastors and ministry leaders not only develop leaders in their own systems, but to help with sabbaticals and learn rhythms of rest. So you can find more about our coaches, Rhonda at Living Wholehearted, Connie at Living Wholehearted, Joe at Living Wholehearted, and obviously Jeff and Tara at Living Wholehearted. You can go to livingwholehearted.com to read their full bios. But know that if you are a leader and you're looking for something that's more holistic, not a coach who's going to tell you to do more, but to help you learn and grow from the inside out, both from spiritual formation, trauma-informed mental health, and really evidence-based leadership principles that we know work on the ground floor, we are the organization for you.
Can I ask you a question, Kurt? What is the power of God's invitation to us mean to you and to those that you have spread this message for as it relates to relational, the actual way in which God wired us to change, to experience him and to experience him through others who are trying to be like him as image bearers? Talk about that, the power of invitation.
Well, I think, Jeff, one thing that has just really recently been captivating my attention has to do with this, what I talk to patients about in the work that we do in these confessional communities, that we are continually moving from imagination to incarnation. That if you look at the entire arc of the biblical narrative from beginning to end, it is one in which God is becoming increasingly incarnate. You go from the fear with the patriarchs to then this burning bush to then this pillar of fire and smoke. And then you have a tabernacle and then you have a temple. And then you get to the Gospels and you have a human being. And even that, Jesus says, that we're not done here, because then you have Pentecost. And now you have lots of human beings. And then you get Revelation 3, where the writer John says that if you overcome, this is to the church of Philadelphia, if you overcome, you will be pillars in the house of my God, right? There's this sense in which we are the embodied, incarnate work of the Holy Spirit in the life of the world and other people. And what's that got to do with invitation? It's easy for us to imagine the Bible and the story and Jesus and all the messages as very, very imaginative. Like I can capture it literally in my imagination. I can hear it from the pulpit. I can read it in the scriptures. I can imagine certain things. But as we like to say, until and or unless I feel something in my chest, it is not yet fully real. And so the invitation that God is inviting and not demanding is something that I like in principle. But until I actually hear it from a real human being who I then have to wrestle with, right? Because, you know, you two can invite me and I might like, you know, it's like it is in every psychotherapy session, right? You see the first time the patient comes, the very first time they come in, the first thing they do is to try to outflank you. They're going to do everything they can. Either they're there to be helped while they're doing everything they can to avoid whatever it is you're going to ask them to do. And by that, we don't mean assignments or homework. Like we're just, what you're asking them to do is to let you love them. That's what you're asking them to do. And it's going to scare the living daylights out of them. And so at the same time that I want this, at the same time that I like the idea of invitation, the viscerally, physically experienced, embodied moment of it also is anxiety provoking. And so when the invitation comes, we also want to be able to say, we're aware, I'm aware that inviting you to do this is really going to, it might be uncomfortable, might be hard to do. And I want you to know that there will be parts of you that might want to do this, and there will be parts of you that really just never want to come back. So we can just acknowledge. So this is like our father in, you know, in Mark 9, who, when he brings his boy to Jesus and Jesus says, do you believe? Yes, I believe. Help thou my unbelief. Help the parts of me that really have no freaking idea about what this is about. And so, again, for our listeners, I just want to affirm that it is not easy for us to believe things in the abstract. We need bone and blood. And this is why Jesus was here, right? This is why we eventually get to where we are. And so even things like hearing your voices, like you're not just giving people information. They can get information by reading it someplace. But people will come to your podcast and they'll log on and they'll hear your voices. And there will be something that will happen to someone because they hear your voice, not because it's just some abstract idea. All the more reason why the podcast is important, why the work you're doing is important, not because of what it is in the abstract, because like the two of you like are the gospel. And we, as we say, we, you know, God takes us far more seriously than we take ourselves. So when Jesus says, like, you will be my witnesses, like, yeah, got it. And yet, I think it's not easy for me to imagine what it means to fully live into what that entails, because I have yet to fully let myself be so loved by him that I can then practice forming hope because of that experience that I've had.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So hope is an intentional, we have to form it. I'm picturing like making bread and like the kneading and having to work to get to that place where it's existent, but there's process, there's ingredients, and key ingredients is human beings with human beings.
Yeah.
And God, that was God's plan. We might not like it, but it was his plan. And the receiving, and I love what, the willingness to receive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that notion, Tara, that sense of like kneading bread, like this sense in which if you're baking bread, there's not like one moment where it just becomes the loaf of bread, right? There's all this kneading. And then even the baking, right? It takes time and it becomes something eventually. And I often think too that we live in a world in which we are so primed to imagine that what we long for in the world is to emerge instantaneously. It's to emerge right now. How I want it, when I want it, where I want it. I'm being trained through Amazon and Google and many, many other things to believe that I should not have to delay gratification. I should not have to suffer. I should not have to, all these. So when the kneading of dough is required, as opposed to just going to Safeway and getting a loaf of bread, it's anxiety provoking, which is why we need other brains in the room to be kneading dough with us to say, no, we can do this. We just stay at it. We can do this.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And when I think I'm doing it wrong, am I doing it right?
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
And then I'm stretching this analogy way too far, but I'm like, and then we bake it, we see the beauty of it, we eat it, and then we got to start over. And so, like,
who has more bread?
I think I'm thinking I'm finally hope filled, and then somehow it like disappears, and now I'm back at the bottom again. And I'm like, okay, this is a process.
Right. Yeah. And I think too, it's kind of like a lot of things, right? Faith, hope, and love. These three remain, but the greatest of these is love. And you might say, well, no wonder, because the other two are in some respects time dependent. Hope is a thing that is a future state. Trust is a thing that I have to, like, I'm still not sure, like I'm having to, as opposed to what does it mean for me? Like when I am in the present moment with those whom I dearly love, when I'm in the present, like one of my really good friends, Bob Phelps, was here earlier this week. And when Bob and I are in the room, and this is true for me and many of my friends, when I'm in the room with Bob, like I'm not trusting any longer. I'm not even thinking about that. We're just with in that moment. And this notion of you, like to your point, like you eat the bread and the bread, and then gosh, I got to start over. I got to like the next loaf of bread. There is this sense in which, with enough practice, even of that, of making loaf after loaf after loaf after loaf, even that becomes something that enables us to form hope. Because we are learning, as we like to say to pay when, you know, how many people have come into your office and said, well, gosh, how long is this going to take? How many sessions do you think? How many sessions is this going to take?
I'm waiting for the person that says, I'll take as long as we need for that.
Right, exactly. Of course.
There's hope.
That's right. Yeah. And when they ask me this question, I say, I think the answer is that it will take as long as it takes for you to get to the point where you love doing the work. At which point they say, wait a minute.
Say what?
Doesn't that mean that I might not ever want to stop doing the work? Right, because the very nature of the question is of the devil, quite literally, right? The very nature of the question emerges from my mind's needing to get to a benchmark so that I can, because it's all out of anxiety. It's all out of my worry. Yeah, it's up to me that like I need to get this done so that I can clear that, I can check that box, I get that, so that I can be relieved and it won't be a problem. As opposed to, I'm not having to worry about where my food is going to come from tomorrow. I'm going to do the work because that's what is before me to do. And not unlike, you know, when Jesus says, like, look, if y'all don't change and become like little kids, like heaven's just not going to work for you. Because you're going to get there and you're going to be looking for benchmark after benchmark. And we're going to be looking at you thinking like those, they don't happen here. Like you're going to be even more troubled in heaven, which would be kind of a bummer. Cause like, you'll be there forever.
A real bummer.
That's so true.
With all these other people who think it's fine.
Right.
There's no project managers that are not people around there.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Oh, it's been such a joy to have you.
Awesome.
And there's so much more I can keep you, but we need to honor your time. Just tell our listeners, where can they find The Deepest Place and all the other amazing books that you've written and resources, your podcast? Point us in the direction.
You're very kind. Yeah. So The Deepest Place, Suffering and the Formation of Hope. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Zondervan's website, Zondervan Books, which is the publisher of the book, which is great. You can also find it. I have my own website, KurtThompsonMD.com. You can find it there. You can download a chapter for free. You can find out more about all this. I have a podcast called The Being Known Podcast, which now is probably the thing that I do that is probably making this work most available, I think. We have a nonprofit called the Center for Being Known that is providing training for the lay public in the development of confessional communities, which is really fun. We have a conference that's coming up in October, the 27th. So you can find out more there. And then I've got accounts on Instagram and Twitter, which is now X, which is whatever that is. I don't keep track of all these things. Yeah. And Facebook. Yeah.
It continues to do the work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Kurt. This has been amazing. Yeah. And it's been great to be with you actually and be present together, the three of us.
Thank you. Well, as you have been running or biking or driving or changing diapers, listening to this, all that information will be in our show notes. So check it out and you'll get all that information and any other resources that Kurt or we have referenced. We're so grateful that you continue to join us every week and continuing to grow and connecting your heart, your mind, your body, and your soul, and moving that all in the same direction. At the end of the day, it's about being together, being known, and living with integrity means just being honest with God and each other. So until next week, I hope that you continue to hope and try again. That's my word. Try with one more. Let's see what God has for you there.
This podcast is powered by Living Wholehearted, Courageous Girls, and the Christian Parenting Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us in this critical movement of shrinking our integrity gaps between what we preach and live.